Alrighty, so this is going to be fun. As you can tell, this is not how I normally sound. I don't think I've ever done this before. Let's hope I can make it all the way through. Real quick, let's take a moment, bow our heads. God, it seems like every time I get up here and talk, I say this. This time I mean it very literally. I need you to talk through me today. Literally. Please be with us as we open your word. As we study the life of one of your ancestors, someone who is an incredible person, help us, Jesus, today to take something from this that we can carry forward the rest of our year. Amen. All right, question to bat around your tables for a couple of minutes. What is the craziest thing someone who has ever done for you? Or if you want to flip it around, what is the craziest, bravest, most insane thing you have done for somebody else? Take a couple minutes. Go. All right. It sounds like we got some good stories. If I can reel you guys back in for a second. Katie's got a mic. Anyone feel care to share any of these stories?
So I met this couple in Barcelona, and we were somewhere on the streets of Barcelona, and I was just talking to different people and telling them about my experience in France and how I'm trying to travel and, like, really get into the culture. And they were like, hey, like, cancel your hostel. You can stay with us. And I didn't know these people. So I was like, But I was like, but it's going to be, like, free food and, like, the hostel. I'll save money. So I was like, you know, like, if I die, I die. It's okay, like... Like, this is the way to die. Like, this is, you know, I've lived a good life. It's okay. You know, so, hey, I'm going to do this. And so, sure enough, I booked that hostel and I died. Yeah. Thanks, Katie. But it was a great experience, but it was crazy. I told my parents afterwards, and my grandmother was like, you did what? How dare you? You're so stupid. She, like, flipped out on me, so. But I'm alive.
Yeah, there are definitely stories you don't ever tell your parents. Anyone else?
I'm going to tell a story for my sister who's actually getting her water bottle right now, but it's a cool story. So when she was a few months old, she was outside while my dad was working, and this was in Malawi, Africa. And while she was in the stroller, a nest of hornets got disturbed, and they started kind of buzzing around her, and my dad ran into the whatever of hornets, swarm of hornets, thanks. To rescue her and pulled her out, and she came out relatively unscathed, but he ended up having to be hospitalized for all the stings that he suffered. Yep.
That's incredible. Ooh, yes. Take maybe one more. Anyone else? All right.
When one of my teacher's students left my school, she was sad, and I felt bad for her. So the next day, I gave her my favorite stuffed animal.
That's amazing. That is awesome. Way to be. All right. It occurs to me now that I listen to your guys' stories, I probably should have had one of my own. I forgot. All right. We're going to talk about a crazy story where someone did something utterly insane. Outside of the cross, it's the greatest act of courage recorded in the Bible, at least to me. We're going to talk about somebody that if I was putting a Mount Rushmore of Bible characters, this person would be on it, up there with Jesus and Moses and David. The person I'm talking about, of course, is Ruth. Ruth's story is utterly incredible. But it's often one that we miss a lot of the meaning in. This is largely because it takes place in a context very alien to our own. As an archaeologist, I love this book because it's unique. Whereas most of the Bible talks about the quote-unquote big people, the kings, the generals, the priests, the prophets, and it focuses on the highlight events of Israel's history, Ruth talks about relatively ordinary people, actually not relatively, very ordinary people, doing an ordinary event that frankly has very little meaning or significance to the rest of the history of Israel. Of course, it begs the question, why is this book even in the record of Israel? Why is it in the Bible? Why did God want this book, this story of this one particular remarkable woman to be preserved? The Bible is a very strange book. Any of us who have ever thoroughly read it, or even cursorily read it, know that it's a very strange book. We read something and we're like, well, that doesn't make sense. Why is that here? Like, does anybody have any idea why the numbers in Numbers are there, the censuses? I mean, has anybody ever read that and said, huh, what's the point of this? I mean, there are certain passages I won't ever teach on, and the censuses in Numbers are one of them. And the reason is because I have no idea what to say. Ruth is another similar book. It doesn't seem to fit the rest of the picture of Israel. It's just a random story. It's a cool story, but it seems random. But it's in here for a reason. After all, this is a divinely inspired book. So it must be here for a purpose. Ruth begins ordinarily enough. In the days of the judges, there was a famine. It seems to be a recurring theme in Bible stories for there to be a famine. But the important part is it was in the days of the judges, or when the judges ruled, or at least attempted to rule. That gives us a framework to place ourselves for this book. And this is something we're going to be doing a lot of this morning. We're going to be grounding ourselves in the framework of the life setting for the story, because we have to understand the culture and the context in which the story took place to understand why it is so remarkable. In the days of the judges, now the days of the judges were crazy. How many of you actually read the book of Judges? How many of you would list it as your favorite book in the Bible? It is the only book of the Bible that I distinctly remember reading for the first time, because I was utterly horrified by what I read. Speaking of passages I will never teach on, Judges 19 through 21 is at the very top of that list. Those of you who know the story I'm talking about know exactly why I won't ever teach on that. Children, do not read that until you're at least 16. It's horrifying. The time of the judges was utter chaos. There was no king. The summation of the time is in those days there was no king, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. It was anarchy. It was chaos. There was no central government. There was no central authority. You did what you wanted, and there were really no consequences. This is the setting in which the book of Ruth takes place. No king, no army, no police force, no enforcement of God's laws. If people live by God's laws, it's because they chose to, not because they had to, and there were plenty of people who did not. So, there was a famine. Again, famine's a common start to most stories in the Bible. There's a famine in the land, and this man named Elimelech of Bethlehem decides to move to Moab. Now to us, it seems fairly normal. You lose your job, you find another job in a different city, you move to that city, start your job. It's normal. As Americans, our culture, our society was largely built on the idea of mobility. People coming over from Europe, seeking a better life, and then people moving west, again, mostly seeking a better life, new opportunities. This is normal to us. But to an Israelite, the idea of leaving your land, the land of your ancestors, was insane. You just didn't do it. If you moved, it was as an absolute last resort, just above cannibalism. So it tells you an idea of how bad this famine was, that Elimelech was willing to leave his land. This idea of land is something we need to take a moment to really unpack, what land meant. There are two things that were crucial and central to an identity of an Israelite: land and family. And it's on these two principles that the whole story of Ruth fixates. Land and family. Land was everything. If you did not have land, you were nothing. Land is where you got your sustenance. You're actually everything. If you wanted food, it's because you had to get it from your land. If you wanted tools, you had to get that from your land. If you wanted clothes, you had to get that from the sheep that you raised on your land. You needed land to survive in the ancient Israel, particularly this time, it's called the early Iron Age part of Israel. Very rural, very agrarian, and they lived on what's called subsistence agriculture, meaning you grew enough for you and your family, really not much else. In rare cases, only in very rare cases, did anyone ever have a surplus of resources. In fact, actually, estimates show that most villages the size of Bethlehem would experience a total shortfall of about 60 days worth of food every year. That's in a normal year. Now, granted, that's not per person, that's for the whole village. But still, there wasn't a surplus of food. So it's not like you could go to the store and buy food. If you wanted food, you had to grow it yourself. If you wanted clothes, you had to get that from your own sheep. If you wanted a sickle, you had to make that from the flint on your own land. Land was everything. If you didn't have land, how did you survive? Sure, you didn't. Or you could sell yourself as a slave to someone who was rich, or you could take up a less than reputable occupation. Land was everything. Because of how important land was to an Israelite, the idea of leaving your land was blasphemous. Your land was sacred. Two centuries later, in the book of 1 Kings, there's a story of King Ahab who goes to a man named Naboth and offers to buy his vineyard. He likes the vineyard. King likes the vineyard and wants to buy it. And he essentially says, name your price. And Naboth says no, because it is too sacred for him to sell his birthright, his land. I mean, how many of us, if a billionaire walked up to us, handed us a blank check and said, I want to buy your house, just fill in the numbers, are going to say no? Naboth said no to that exact offer, because the land was so sacred to him, and to any Israelite, you don't sell it. And the only reason you would sell it is if you absolutely had to. And even then, in theory, again, days of the judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. In theory, even if you sold your land, the land after 7 years was supposed to come back to you. Land was sacred, and Elimelech left it. Tells you how dire the situation was. But that's not even the most shocking part. He left it to go to Moab. Moab. Now, we have to stop here and back up a little bit in Israel's history to understand their, let's call it, rocky relationship with Moab. In the book of Numbers, there's the fun story of Balaam and his talking donkey. And the part we often stop at Balaam giving these amazing blessings to Israel. But it's not actually where the story ends. You see, Balaam wanted his money, and he told the king of Moab how to get the Israelites. He says, send down your women, have them mingle with the men, and invite them to your parties that are sacrificing to their gods. Which Balak, the king of Moab, did. Make a long story short, Israel went off the beaten path. A lot of people died. Israelites don't like Moabites. Israelites viewed Moabites as these seductresses, these evil, idolatrous people. And when you hang around Moabites, bad things happen, and you tend to die. And this is where Elimelech goes. He goes to Moab. Again, a very strange choice of locations. In fact, actually, in the book of Deuteronomy, I believe Deuteronomy 23, verse 2, God specifically commands that Moabites and Israelites are not supposed to mix. And this is where Elimelech goes. You don't hang out with Moabites. And you certainly don't marry them. So naturally, of course, Elimelech marries both of his sons, Mahlon and Chilion, to two Moabite seductresses, Ruth and Orpah. Unsurprisingly, the sons and Elimelech are soon dead. I mean, what do you expect? You hang out with Moabites. This is what happens. Didn't he learn anything in history? So at this point, Elimelech's wife, Naomi, is left alone. She's a widow, probably landless widow, living in a foreign country. Her two daughters-in-law are now also widows. But at least they're living in their own country. And now we have to talk about the other part of an Israelite's identity. Family. Family was everything. In our culture, in our society, the most basic social unit is the individual. I am a unique, distinct entity of my own. Michael is a unique, distinct entity of his own. However, in ancient Israelite society, I am not a person. I am not a social unit of my own. The most basic social unit, the lowest denominator you could break down society into, was not individuals, but families. You did not exist on your own as an individual. You only existed in the context of your family. There's a good reason for this. When you consider how life worked, again, if you wanted something, you had to make it yourself. There is no mass production. There is no Walmart or Amazon. If you want food, you have to grow the grain, harvest the grain, thresh the grain, grind the grain into flour, and then bake the bread. If you want clothes, you have to raise the sheep. You have to shear the sheep. You have to spin the wool into yarn after cleaning it. Then you have to weave the yarn into fabric. Then you have to sew the fabric into clothes. If you want a sickle, I think you get the idea. It is functionally impossible for any one individual to do all of that. And these are all basic, necessary things to survive. You need clothes. You need food. So it was physically impossible for any one person to survive on their own unless, A, they inherited enough wealth to hire people to do these various activities, which, again, very few people could, or B, sold themselves as slaves, or C, took up a less than reputable occupation. You could not functionally survive without family. As a side note, this is largely where gender roles come from. Everyone needed to have a purpose and function in the family. Gender roles don't necessarily come from, not entirely anyway, a misguided sense of sexism. It comes from a functional necessity of life, of survival. A functional necessity that doesn't actually exist anymore, by the way. Without your family, you're nothing. And as a result of this, much like land, if you don't have a family, you don't exist. Family was more than just, it was your source of survival and sustenance, but also became your source of protection, your source of legal protection. Remember, this is the days of the judges. There is no king. There is no central authority. There is no police officer to enforce laws. People policed themselves, and the way they did that was through their family. So if someone messed with me, my family would then go attack them. And the idea is, thank you, Deborah. The idea is that there's kind of this tense, almost mad doctrine, mutually assured destruction doctrine going on, where I don't mess with you because I don't want your family coming after me, and you don't mess with me because you don't want my family coming after you. And we actually see this play out in the book of Genesis, where Jacob's daughter Dinah is raped by a man named Shechem. Dinah's brothers, Simeon and Levi, go ahead and massacre every man in the city. Now, while what Shechem did to Dinah was horrible, I think we can all agree that Simeon and Levi's reaction was a bit much. But Jacob's problem with his sons wasn't the fact that they massacred a city. His problem was that now they had extended this blood feud way beyond what his little band could handle. Kind of gives you an idea of the mindset. So again, the question is, what happens if you don't have a family? What do you do? What happens if you're not part of the house of the father, the Beit Av? You are totally vulnerable, totally exposed. Anyone can do anything they want to you. And unless somebody else, out of the goodness of their heart, decides to come to your defense, there will be absolutely no repercussions whatsoever. This is why there are three people that the Bible again refers to over and over as the people that must be taken care of: the widow, the orphan, and the foreigner. The three people who don't have family. Because those three people in Israelite society do not exist as human beings. They have no one to protect them, no one to provide for them. and no one to argue their case before the elders that would form the de facto court system. If you don't have that, you are completely reliant on the mercy of those around you. Which, if the story of a certain Bethlehemite concubine in Judges 19 is any indication, I wouldn't want to be at the mercy of the Israelites. So this is where Naomi's at. She has no family. She probably doesn't have any land. And she's a foreigner in Moab. She decides it's probably time to go back to Bethlehem. And as she's heading off, her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth, decide to come with her. And Naomi tells them, "What are you, nuts? Go home. Go back to your Beit Av. Go back to your family where you'll be provided for. You'll be protected. You'll have someone who will get you husbands, and you will live your life. Coming with me, there is nothing for you there. I am a widow. I have no one. I'm past the age of having kids. I don't exist in society. I may have a clan, an extended family that may or may not help me, but they're not going to help you. There's nothing for you in Bethlehem. Go home." Orpah smartly does. But what Ruth does is astonishing. She says, "Nope, I'm coming with you." Again, I want you to think of what Ruth's decision in the context of what we just talked about. She is intentionally, willingly going back to a place where she hits the social outcast bingo. She is a widow. She is now basically orphaning herself. And she's a foreigner. And just to add a cherry on top, she's a Moabite. She has absolutely no social standing. A squirrel from Mars has more social standing in Israel than Ruth does. Anybody can do anything they want to her. And again, if the story of the Bethlehemite concubine and the Benjamites is any indication of how they treat a quote-unquote Israelite, just imagine how the people of Israel are going to treat a Moabite, who they expect to be the sultry seductress. And she's going back anyway? When you think of it from that perspective, outside of the cross, it is the single greatest act of courage in the entire Bible. And there's a definite connection between those two events. We'll come back to that before we close. She puts herself in a position to have anything at all happen to her. And if I've observed anything from social media, when people don't have repercussions for their actions, they almost always revert to the worst possible tendencies of humanity. And Ruth does it anyway. The Bible doesn't specifically say why, but I think we can guess by reading between the lines. Naomi wasn't going back to be with family. Naomi wasn't going back to find a home. Naomi was going back to die. She'd given up on life. She even changed her name to Mara, bitterness, because her life was bitter. Ruth knew that if she let Naomi go alone, Naomi would go back to Bethlehem. And as soon as she could, she'd find some street corner, curl up, and die. And Ruth was not going to let that happen. I don't know how their relationship had formed. The Bible doesn't go into the details. But Ruth loved Naomi. And she was going to put everything on the line. Put herself in the most exposed, vulnerable position anyone could possibly put themselves in. Because she was not going to let Naomi give up and die. And so she said, "No, I am coming with you. I am not leaving you. Let's go." She gives that famous, powerful statement. "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And where you die, I will die. And where you are buried, I will be buried. I don't care about the risk. I don't care what happens. I am going to do everything I can to keep you alive. And whatever happens to me, happens to me." is incredible. In our society, I don't think there is an adequate parallel that we could relate to understand just how brave, how courageous, how borderline insane what Ruth did was. And it doesn't even stop there. They get back to Bethlehem. The first problem, of course, is food. Luckily, they timed their arrival right, because they timed it during the harvest. So Ruth goes out into the fields and starts gleaning. Now again, there are supposed to be social justice laws that allow for widows and orphans and foreigners to get food. But again, in those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in their eyes, blah, blah, blah. Whether people actually follow those laws or not is anyone's guess. Luckily, or fortunately, or divine intervention, there happens to be one particular individual in Bethlehem who does follow these laws. Boaz, who's described as a man of worthy character or a great warrior, a hero. And Ruth, thank God, is led to his fields. Again, when she goes out to the fields, she's taking a huge risk. She's going outside the town where things are supposed to have at least a semblance of order. She's going in a place where she is exposing herself to anyone and anything. People could steal from her, they could rape her, they could kill her. And as the Moabite seductress, not only would they not defend her, they would probably blame her. But of course, they also need to eat, so she doesn't really have much of a choice. She goes out to the fields, and God sends her to Boaz, who thankfully takes care of her. Makes sure that she makes sure, first off, three times he emphasizes, leave this woman alone. Do not touch her. If you touch her, you will answer to me, and you do not want to do that. He takes her unofficially into his own Beit Av. He offers her his protection, which for Boaz himself is a bit of a risk. After all, he is now associating with the Moabites. Dangerous stuff. When Naomi hears about this, she starts perking up. For the first time, she sees a little bit of hope, because she knows that Boaz is a close relative of her dead husband. A certain thing called levirate marriage. If a man dies without leaving his widow any sons, the next closest relative is supposed to provide her with sons, provide her with a family to keep going. Now, Naomi may be Now, technically, it's supposed to be Naomi that receives this, but she's, at this point, past the age of bearing children, so that falls to Ruth. But does this apply to Ruth? She's not an Israelite. It's a little sketchy. So Naomi concocts a rather bold plan that she sends Ruth on. Around the time of the threshing, it's probably a month or two later, after they first get back, Naomi has Ruth bathe, wear her best clothes, put on some perfume, and go to Boaz on the threshing floor in the middle of the night. You have to understand, the threshing season was the high point of the year. Imagine that you get paid once a year, okay? Most of us get paid every couple weeks or every month or something like that. Now imagine that you get paid only once a year. I imagine for all of us, that payday, once a year, is going to be a pretty big day. We're probably going to celebrate. And that's basically what threshing was. It's when the work culminated, or the work of harvesting culminated. It's when you were at your richest, because you had all the food there together on your threshing floor. So threshing season was always a big celebration. And so it's at this time, Naomi wants to send Ruth, who is wearing her best clothes, she's washed, she's wearing perfume, to Boaz, a man, in the middle of the night. Do you know who else is washing themselves, wearing perfume and fancy clothes, and meeting men in the middle of the night on threshing floors? Prostitutes. Naomi is asking Ruth to be every negative stereotype of Moabites, because she's just that desperate to have a new son and to have a family that continues on. I don't think any of us would have blamed Ruth if she said, yeah, how about I don't do that? There are only about a million ways that this could go wrong. Boaz is a man of high character, and if I show up in his bed, basically, on the threshing floor in the middle of the night looking like this, he's only going to think I'm there for one reason. And I don't think he's going to like it. Or worse, he might, and then just toss me aside because he owes me nothing. I'm a Moabite. There are a million ways that this could go wrong. But once again, because she loves Naomi, Ruth does it anyway. Now, she doesn't completely go insane and say, hey, here I am. Let's figure this out. She offers Boaz an opportunity to redeem her, much like he would redeem the land. The idea of the nearest relative buying the land for someone too poor to maintain it themselves. Which sounds a lot better than just crawling into bed. Although she does scare the living daylights out of Boaz, apparently, who wakes up in the middle of the night with this woman just like lying there. He's like, what is going on? Again, Ruth puts everything on the line for Naomi. Boaz could have killed her, he could have raped her, or both. He could have, at the very least, just kicked her out and sent her on her way. He could have lost all respect for her. He calls her at one point in Hebrew, the word is Isha Hayil, a woman of strength, a mighty woman. Essentially, Boaz calls Ruth Wonder Woman, which is probably very appropriate. He has a great deal of respect for her. And if she showed up like a prostitute, like every negative stereotype of a Moabite, he could have very easily lost all respect for her and sent her home. And that might have been the best case scenario. Again, God gave Ruth wisdom to give the right words to say, the right scenario to suggest. And Boaz's respect for her only grows. And we know how the rest of the story goes. She goes home the next morning after apparently, I guess, they discussed furniture all night or something. The next day, Boaz goes to the city gate. He challenges the actual closest relative to Elimelech. And he gains Ruth's hand and marries her. And the story ends with a short genealogy. Ruth begot Obed, who begot Jesse, who begot some guy named David. Skip ahead a few books to the book of Matthew. Ruth is one of five women mentioned in Matthew's genealogy of Christ. Mary, of course. The wife of Uriah, Bathsheba as we know her. Ruth, Rahab, and Tamar. Interesting, only two of those women are Israelites. Ruth, again and again, risked everything for Naomi because she loved her, because she wasn't going to let her give up, because she wasn't going to let her just curl up and die. And in the end, Naomi says, my name is Naomi because my life is pleasant. I have life again. Everything Ruth sacrificed, everything Ruth risked, worked out. Ruth's story shadows the greatest act of courage in the entire Bible, which Mike talked about last week. The pre-existent, almighty, immortal God becoming incarnate, vulnerable, weak in the person of Jesus. The God who laid everything on the line, risked eternal damnation to save you and me. Ruth prefigures Christ. As Mike talked about last week, Christ, we are now the body of Christ. What are you willing to risk? What are you willing to do for those in the world around us? For those in the south side of Chattanooga? What are we willing to put on the line? As we think about the new year coming up and New Year's resolutions, for those of you who are into that sort of thing. What are you willing to resolve to do? How far are you willing to go? Are you willing to go as far as Ruth did? Are you willing to risk everything for the people around you? Because that is what Christ ended up risking for us. And if we are the body of Christ, we have to ask ourselves, how much like him are we really?